welcome to today's podcast, Design for Life. This is the seventh in the series titled Leadership Profiles. Life wasn't created at a whim, nor should it be lived that way. This podcast is taken from the Sunday message. It is designed to strengthen the believer's walk and those who have not come to faith to recognize God has designed life to be lived with purpose. I'm Pastor David, the assistant pastor at Bethel Gilead Community Church, also known as the Church on Block Road. Here is Pastor Jim with this week's message, Models and Mentors.
Working our way through Chronicles, talking about leadership profiles. You know what a profile is, don't you? Ever seen a profile of a profile shot of somebody? It's a side view of that person's, an outline of their face. Or a profile in business, it's an outline, an overview of that person's career, let's say. Profiles. And what we have in Chronicles is really a side view. It's an overview. It's an outline of the lives of some 20-plus kings. And these are kings of the southern kingdom of Israel after it has divided. It's a divided nation, the north and the south. And this is, in fact, the lineage of David, the kings of Israel. And so we're following those kings here, and we're looking at the outlines, the profiles of each. And we're discerning what can we find in each that is good or is bad, and how can we apply those things to our lives. Well, last weekend, Kim and I took a break from Chronicles. We had a good getaway. Several of you have asked us about our time birding. You ever heard of the phrase, such and such, or this thing is for the birds? It's for the birds. Yeah, that came out of apparently World War II. That was a code language in World War II. And it had the idea of something being senseless or worthless. Ah, it's for the birds. You know, that's for the birds. Well, Jesus, on the other hand, said, consider the birds of the air. And Kim and I learned here years ago that that was something that was both refreshing and encouraging, fun to do. But it was taking a look at birds and paying attention to the birds and learning life lessons, as Jesus suggests to his own disciples, from the birds. So last weekend, we headed up to Taos Point, do this annually for the Warbler Festival. Anybody been to Taos Point State Park? It's a great place. Excellent opportunity to get away, to get outside, to do some camping, to hang out with some of our favorite people. It's an excuse, really, to go birding just to get alone, away from the phone, and spend some time with my wife. A little bit chilly last weekend, but not overly so. Actually, it was a nice first couple of days. Last day or so was chilly. You need a fire at night. That's always nice. Get out and do some camping. I met this gypsy woman on the path and invited her over to the campfire. But our focus, as I suggested earlier, was birds. And there are some 30 warblers that you are probably not aware of that come through Michigan every year. Look at how colorful and beautiful these birds are. They're the size of wrens. They are songbirds. They sing. If you don't tune into their song, and if you're not in the right place at the right time, you're going to miss them, because most of these are Canadian birds. They're coming from the Caribbean, some as far as South America, and usually the first 2 weeks of May. They're passing through Michigan. And boy, we didn't do the final count there, 18 or 20 of the 30, I think we saw this weekend, which was pretty good, along with about 100 other species of birds that were on the island or the point during the time that we were there, those couple of days, Taos Point. Now, the interesting thing about migration is you don't see typically flocks of these birds because they migrate at night. Let me show you what that looks like. That red line is the sunset. The birds are being picked up on radar. That's the weather radars that's picking up birds around the United States last night. Notice the blank spaces. The black spaces is where there's weather issues, wind or weather that keeps it. And let's watch. Sunset's going to come through with the red. Birds come alive last night and they travel. The lighter the color, the more birds that are traveling per square kilometer. Every night throughout the spring, whether you realize it or not, birds are moving. Jesus said, consider the birds of the air. You might want to take some time while they're still here, while they're still singing, before they start their nesting and kind of settle down for the summer and you miss seeing or hearing them, to consider the birds of the air. That's all we did. We just took some time off to do what Jesus told us to do. So if you think life is for the birds, just talk to the air ones. We'll tell you otherwise. There's some neat things happening in that department. This morning, I'd like to look at an unusual character. This guy, I think, is unusual because he's a good king surrounded by bad people. You know, some of the best kids come out of some of the worst homes. Have you noticed that? How is that possible? Who is it that influences that kid, if not the parents, the grandparents, the immediate family? There has to be either a model or a mentor that comes into that person's life and rescues, so to speak, that person from bad situations. The opposite is also true, however, because each of us are free agents. Some of the best kids or some of the worst kids come out of some of the best homes. Have you noticed that as well? Again, that kid has free agency. He or she can make decisions regardless of what we as parents determine or decide or wish for them, oftentimes via, again, models and mentors. Peer influence is one of the big ones. Kids are led astray. Our king this morning is Joash, and you'll find his story here in 2 Chronicles chapter 24. Pick up with me just a few passages or verses from that text. Joash was 7 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 40 years. Well, that's a standard lifetime generation, 40 years in the Bible. King Saul reigned 40 years. King David reigned 40 years. King Solomon reigned 40 years. But we're going to find, and we are finding as we read the accounts of these kings, that most of the kings don't make it that long. Only a few make it to 40, and a couple make it actually to 50. 55 is the longest tenure of one of the kings that we'll see here in Chronicles. 7 years old, second grade king. What does that guy have to offer the country? I mean, we're still working on the three R's at that point, reading, writing, and arithmetic. In my case, there was a fourth R. It was recess growing up. That was very significant. But you remember when we used to have recesses? What happened to recess anyway? In second grade, we had three recesses. I don't know about your school, but we were such rascals that the teachers determined we got to get these kids outside. You talk about hyperactive disorder. Let them run, burn off some of that energy. So three times a day, we went out for recess, short periods. I've always tried to reinstill that with parenting, too. Hang on, kids, I'm going to take a recess. I'll be back in about 20 minutes. I need a break here. Second grader becomes king. The reality is, Israel, or actually Judah, the southern kingdom, is being ruled by a surrogate king, by the mentor of this king. His name is Jehoiada. Jehoiada. He's a bright light shining in a dark time. And when we think about leadership profiles, what we see here is the influence, the leadership, and that's my definition of leadership. When I started this series, somebody said, well, I'm just not a leader. I mean, this isn't for me. I say wrong. In my opinion, that the easiest or the shortest definition of leadership is influence. And everybody influences people to some degree, for good or for bad. Influence. To that degree, you are leading others. And what we find in Chronicles that substantiates the reign of Joash is his mentor and model. It's Jehoiada. Joash was 7 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 40 years. His mother's name was Zibiah, and she was from Beersheba. Verse 2, Joash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. That's a phrase that we've noted here, haven't we? So-and-so did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. Usually it refers back to David, according to his father David. But the opposite phrase is seen more often than not. So-and-so did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord as king of the land. Joash is one of the good guys. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all the years of Jehoiada, the priest, his mentor and model. In fact, verse 3, Jehoiada did what his father should have done. Why didn't his father do it? His father was assassinated. We'll find that out in just a minute. He's absent. Jehoiada steps in, and he helps him choose wives. And he had sons and daughters, as was pertinent for kings of Judah. Why? They had to reproduce. Why? Because the lineage of Christ would come from the kings of Judah, the southern kingdom. Remember? The line of David would ultimately produce the Messiah in Israel. And so it was necessary for every one of these kings to have children, sons in particular, as it is here with Joash. Now, the neat thing about Joash is this guy is alive not only during the administration of Jehoiada, not only the administration of Joash the king, but of several previous kings that succeeded him. At least three, if not four, administrations of Judah, Jehoiada was acting as priest, maybe not high priest, but as priest in the temple in Jerusalem. And the interesting thing, as I noted up front, is the context of Joash's reign, I'm sorry, as he steps up to the plate, is it's dark time. It's a dark era. There are several evil kings that rise to power, namely his father and his grandfather are evil men. Let's go back and survey chapter 21 in 2 Chronicles, starting with the first of the two, the grandfather, Jehoram. 2 Chronicles 2, pick up there in verse 2. When Jehoram established himself firmly over his father's kingdom. His father was Hezekiah, incidentally. Hezekiah was one of the greatest of the kings. Here's an example of a guy who had an excellent upbringing. He had all the advantages that life could offer, and he turned south. There's good reason for it. We'll see it in the text here. Jehoram. When he established himself firmly over his father's kingdom, he put all his brothers to the sword, along with some of the princes of Israel. He assassinated the whole family, so there would be no competition and no doubt that he was king. Talk about insecure. Jehoram was 32 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 8 years. Well, in contrast to the 40 years that his grandson Joash would rule. Notice the description. He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. Who are the kings of Israel? Northern kingdom. There wasn't one good king that ruled in Israel during the years that they existed as a northern kingdom. He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel in the house of Ahab, or as the house of Ahab had done. For he married a daughter of Ahab. Boy, think of Moby Dick, don't you, Captain Ahab? I suspect he picked off that name from the Bible. Turn over to 1 Kings. Chapter 16, let me share with you a little bit of the kind of guy that Ahab was. First and Second Kings record the account of both the southern and the northern kingdoms of Israel at this time. Chronicles only the southern kings, the lineage of David. So we have to go to the First Kings to find out a little bit about who was in power at the time in the northern kingdom. What about Ahab? Verse 28, Omri rested with his fathers and was buried in Samaria. That is the capital of the northern kingdom. And Ahab, his son, succeeded him as king. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, son of Omri, became king of Israel, and he reigned in Samaria over Israel 22 years. Notice verse 30, Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. He was the worst of the worst in the northern kingdom. Verse 31, not only did he consider it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. Jeroboam had set up two golden calves in the north and the south of the newly established northern kingdom. Not only did he consider those sins trivial, but he also married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and he began to serve Baal and worship him. Baal is one of the most heinous of the pagan gods. Hold off on that thought a couple of weeks here, because we're going to look at two of the worst of the kings of the southern kingdom, where we find ourselves in Chronicles. And I'm going to suggest there's an interesting parallel between the gods that they worshipped, the false gods, the idols, and the idols that Americans worship today. We might do well just to go back and prep ourselves. There's some interesting similarities between what you and I consider in modern society, or what we could consider to be idols, and what they actually worshiped in those days. Ahab, worshiping Baal. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal, and in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. And Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than did all the kings of Israel before him. He was a bad guy, and Jehoram marries into the family. He marries his daughter, as we're told here in the text in 2 Chronicles. It's not a good scenario. It's not a good situation. As a result, in summary, chapter 21 there, back in 2 Chronicles, God raises up. It's God who raises opposition to this evil king. Verse 8, he raises up the Edomites who rebel against, they were under the authority of Israel or Judah, and they rebel. He raises up Libna, who revolted at the same time. And the text says, because Jehoram had forsaken the Lord, the God of his fathers. A little bit farther on, verse 16, he roused against Jehoram the hostility of the Philistines. They reappear. Thought they were conquered foes. Boy, they rise up at this point. They take advantage of the moment, a weak moment in Judah. And the Arabs who live near the Cushites. And they go on the offensive. They attack Israel during the administration of Jehoram. In fact, verse 17 says they attacked Judah, invaded it, and carried off all the goods found in the king's palace, together with his sons and his wives. Not a son was left to him except Ahaziah, the youngest. That's significant because that's exactly what Elijah the prophet suggested would happen. If you're in chapter 21, verse 12 there, let me read this word from Elijah. Now, this is significant because, and I'm trying to keep the two apart here, if you've noticed, because Elijah, the prophet Elijah, prophesies or preaches to the northern kingdom. But he makes an exception here. Things are looking so bad as he looks over the border in the southern kingdom that he sends a message, a text message, to Jehoram the king. This is what the Lord, the God of your father David, says. You have not walked in the ways of your father Jehoshaphat or of Asa, king of Judah, but you have walked in the ways of the kings of Israel and have led Judah and the people of Jerusalem to prostitute themselves, just as the house of Ahab did. You have also murdered your own brothers, members of your father's house, men who were better than you. Sounds like Cain and Abel, doesn't it? Better than you. So now the Lord is about to strike your people, your sons, your wives, everything that is yours with a heavy blow. You yourself will be very ill with a lingering disease of the bowels until the disease causes your bowels to come out. Boy, that does not sound good. And in fact, in fulfillment of his prophecy, the Philistines, the Arabs, come and they take captive his whole family, it says here in the text. And in fact, he becomes ill with an incurable disease of the bowels, the text tells us. Verse 19, in the course of time, at the end of the second year, his bowels came out because of the disease, and he died in great pain. You know, it's impossible to do wrong and feel right. It's impossible to do bad and feel good, although every temptation would suggest the opposite. If you want to feel good, go for it. All kinds of pain are the result of sin. For good reason, God gives us 10 commandments, guidelines to live by, because he wants you and I to avoid the pain and the suffering that comes from things like, boy, adultery, as we saw this morning, and all the pain that that creates in lives, marriages, and families. As a result of his sin, he dies in great pain. Notice the conclusion of the text. His people made no fire in his honor as they had his fathers. They didn't commemorate his loss. There was no funeral service or memorial. Nobody felt like going. There was nothing good to remember. Jehoram was 32 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 8 years. He passed away to no one's regret and was buried in the city of David, but not in the tomb of the kings. They buried him, but not in the royal cemetery, because he wasn't worthy of it. That is the grandfather of the king Joash, a model and example in his life, led astray by the wicked king Ahab's daughter. When we pick up chapter 22, Joash's father, if you're with me here, the context of his administration coming from this background is Ahaziah, who survived the routing by the Arabs, as we just read. Chapter 22, if you're there with me, let's just read as well a couple of verses from this chapter in summary. Ahaziah was 22 years of age, this is verse 2, when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem. How many years? He got 1 year. Just one. His mother's name was Athaliah, a granddaughter of Omri, who is the father of Ahab. Athaliah, we get her name here because we're going to need it in just a minute. She asserts herself in his absence, we'll see. He too walked in the ways of the house of Ahab, for his mother encouraged him in doing wrong, just like she had her husband, the previous king. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, as the house of Ahab had done. For after his father's death, they became his advisors, and that to his undoing. And he also followed their counsel. And so it goes on. We see him in league with the northern kingdom here. And he goes to the battle and actually goes to visit, as I summarize the chapter here, the wounded king of Israel. And that act itself, it leads to his own undoing. He's in the process of going to see the king, and he himself is executed. And he dies after 1 year in office. And the wicked queen mother, sounds like Snow White, doesn't it? The wicked queen mother takes the throne for just a short time, for some 6-7 years. Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab, the wife of Jehoram, the mother of Ahaziah, when her son is killed, She takes the wheel. Reminds me, if you're familiar with the story of Juan Perón, the Peronist in Argentina and South America. And when he died suddenly in 1974, his wife Isabel succeeded him as president of the nation. And things went downhill fast for the country. She takes over, and she makes a major mess of everything at this point. Verse 10, let me pick up there in the text. When Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she proceeded to destroy the whole royal family of the house of Judah. Why in the world? She's gone berserk here. She's putting to death everyone in the lineage of Ahaziah, her son. Why would she do that? Because the devil is out to destroy the line of David. He understands what was prophesied hundreds of years prior to David, that from your own seed, from your lineage, would come who? Again, Messiah. Reminiscent of King Herod. The wise men, tell me where he is so that I too may go and worship him. The wise men warned in a dream did not go back to Jerusalem. They went a different way home, didn't they? They smelled a rat here. Something isn't right with King Herod. And they were exactly right. He sends his soldiers to Bethlehem and with the instructions, put to death every boy 2 years old or younger. Let's liquidate the line of David. And so we destroy the work of God on earth, the Messiah who was promised to come as a king in the lineage of David. I think it's the devil instigating, as always, in this situation. Verse 10, verse 11, but Jehosheba, boy, we got to work on some words again here, don't we? Jehosheba, the daughter of King Jehoram. Now, we're getting a little bit, this is getting convoluted, isn't it, here, a little bit. Jehoram's daughter, princess Jehosheba, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him away from among the royal princes who were about to be murdered. And she put him and his nurse in a bedroom. She senses that there's a conspiracy afoot. As she sees this wicked woman taking action here in her son's stead, he's dead. She steps up as the queen mother of the land. And she sets out to destroy the lineage of David via the seed of, or the line of Ahaziah. Jehosheba, the daughter of the king, takes Joash and steals him away. Notice, because Jehosheba, the daughter of King Jehoram, was the wife of the priest Jehoiada. It's a couple thing here, the influence that they wield in the life of this budding king, Joash. She was Azaziah's sister. She hid the child from Athaliah so that she could not kill him. And he remained hidden with them at the temple of God for 6 years while Athaliah ruled the land. The temple was like this. It was a big building, but it had side rooms off to the side. The main room where everything happened was in the temple. That you had the curtain up front. The Holy of Holies was the place where the high priest could only go once a year. And then you had the candles that were lit, the candles of incense, and everything else, and people could come into a certain point and they couldn't go any farther. But on the side were rooms, like we've got a storage room, as if that room back there were a storage room. And apparently in one of those storage rooms, they hid away this kid. Joash is a baby for 6 years while Athaliah ruled the land. And so enters Jehoiada to the rescue here, chapter 23. If you're following with me, in the seventh year of Jehoiada, in the seventh year that he is hiding or hidden, Jehoiada showed his strength. He steps up to the plate. He swings the bat. He made a covenant with the commander of units of hundreds. He contacts the army leaders. He says, okay, we've got to band together here. got a mission to accomplish. It's to put a new king on the throne. So dethrone this woman, illegitimate leader, and to put the legitimate line of David in his place. And so they covenant. They commit to do this. He announces exactly what the plan is. He gets all the priests and all those who worked in the temple together, and they establish themselves with this plan so that on a certain day they would present the king as a coronation day, and they carry it off without a hitch. Verse 11, Jehoiada and his sons brought out the king's son, put a crown on him. They presented him with a copy of the covenant, the law, the Old Testament. It was the job of the kings to read the law every year. They had to know, I mean, like a lawyer or somebody would have to know the rules of the law. They had to know what the Bible said. They gave him a copy of the covenant and proclaimed him king. They anointed him and shouted, "Long live the king." Verse 12, when Athaliah, the wicked queen mother, heard the noise of the people running and cheering for the king, she went to them at the Lord's temple. Excuse me. She looked, and there was the king standing by his pillar at the entrance. The officers and the trumpeters were beside the king, and all the people in the land were rejoicing and blowing trumpets with singers and musical instruments. They were leading praises. Then Athaliah tore her robes and shouted, "Treason! Treason!" Jehoiada the priest sent out the commanders of the units of hundreds who were in charge of the troops, and he said to them, "Bring her out between the ranks. Put her sword to the sword, her and anyone who follows her." For the priest had said, Do not put anyone to death in the temple. Take her outside and put her to death. They seized her as she reached the entrance of the horse gate in the palace grounds. There they put her to death. Then Jehoiada made a covenant, he and the people and the king, that they would be the Lord's people from this point forward. Like Joshua, "As for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord." Agreed? They agreed to it, the influence of Jehoiada. And so comes Joash at 7 years of age onto the scene. The legacy of Joash is very simply stated. He reestablishes temple worship. He puts the temple back in its central position in the southern kingdom. He establishes a temple tax according to Exodus 30. When you took a census, everyone would pay a half a shekel. So he apparently takes a census and establishes a tax in order to refurbish the temple, to pay for the workers who would do the job. And it is noted, and he is applauded for his efforts in that respect of making sure that only the priests ran the show in the temple. Why was that important? Well, let me just highlight one verse from chapter 24, verse 7. Now the sons of that wicked woman, Athaliah, had broken into the temple of God and used even its sacred object for the Baals. Notice there's an S on Baals. There was only one Baal, but Baals was a code word for all the gods. Oftentimes when you see it pluralized like that, it means the gods, the false gods. And so the temple was destroyed in essence under Athaliah. And Joash sets out to reestablish it. That's not the end of the story, however. There's a bad turn here in Joash's administration. Verse 15. Now Jehoiada was old and full of years, and he died at the age of 130. Boy, you don't find people living to 130 at this time. You do previously in biblical history, don't you? That's pretty unusual. 130. Again, if you do the math and you back up, the two wicked kings was 9 years between the two, 1 and 8 years. This guy was around for Hezekiah. He was around for Asa. He saw probably the administration of 5 different kings, akin to Billy Graham and his ministry to the presidents. If you read the story of Billy Graham and his life, you'll find that he ministered to all kinds of a series of presidents over a period of some 40 years until he himself died. So it was, I think, with Jehoiada, although we're not given information about any but Joash here and his influence in his life. 130, and he was buried with the kings in the city of David. He was given a royal burial, even though he wasn't a king. They buried him in the royal cemetery. Unlike the previous two kings, who were excluded from the cemetery, they put Jehoiada the priest out there in that extra plot instead. Because he was good, and because of all the good that he had done for Israel, for God, and for the temple. Notice verse 17, after the death of Jehoiada, the officials of Judah came and paid homage to the king, and he listened to them. Took a poll. Let's do what the people want. This is a monarchy. It's not a democracy at this point. But he says, well, let's decide what everybody else wants at this point. No number is given. We don't know how long into his 40-year reign this occurs. I'm hoping, suggesting probably somewhere towards the end. But it's hard for me to believe, with all the advantages he had under Jehoiada, that he would throw it all aside, other than I see it all the time. In fact, you and I have both been tempted to chuck it all, to put it all aside for the sake of unwanted gain, some kind of pleasure or vice, something that is evil. They abandoned the temple of the Lord, the God of their fathers, and worshiped Asherah. Asherah poles and idols. Because of their guilt, God's anger came upon Judah and Jerusalem, although the Lord sent prophets. Now, we haven't been doing this, but you can go to the minor prophets, major and minor prophets in the Old Testament. It's the last section of the Old Testament. And those prophets are preaching during this era. We just saw Elijah sending a letter to the previous king, didn't we? And if you align their messages with the right side of the line, north or south, you get a feel for what else is happening at the time. There are prophets who are active. As always, God is speaking clearly truth. And in this case, they're not dissuaded. They're not persuaded by it. Although the Lord sent his prophets to the people to bring them back to him, though they testified against them, they would not listen. Then the Spirit of God came upon Zechariah, son of Jehoiada. Who was Jehoiada in Joash's life? He was his model and mentor. He was the man that made all the difference in his life. He owed much of his success to the influence, the leadership of that priest. And his son steps up in his stead. And notice how he treats him. The son of Jehoiada, led by the Spirit of God, stood before the people and he said, this is what God says. Why do you disobey the Lord's commands? You will not prosper. Because you have forsaken the Lord, he has forsaken you. He extends a bony finger right in the face of the people and he says, you've left the Lord. And the fact of the matter is he's leaving you. But they plotted against him. And by order of the king, they stoned him to death in the courtyard of the Lord's temple. They put him to death. King Joash did not remember the kindness Zechariah's father Jehoiada had shown him. But he killed his son. It was said as he lay dying, may the Lord see this and call you to account. And certainly he does. Within a year, as you finish the story, the army from the north, from Syria, Aramites attack, and they decimate Judah. And it's explained because Judah had forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers. Judgment was executed on Joash. Boy, he was going strong, wasn't he? But he stumbles at the finish line, and he finishes weak. Second Peter chapter 1, you don't need to go there. Let me read these words. Peter says this, "And we have the word of the prophets made more certain, and you will do well to pay attention to it," to the word of the prophets, "as a light shining in a dark place." That's exactly what God's word can do for you. It's like a lamp, David said, for my feet. It can enlighten your life if you'll let it do that, if you'll pay attention. The word of the prophets. Zechariah was one of those, and they did not listen. And they paid sorely. Joash is wounded in battle. An assassination plot comes forward, and he's executed in his own bed. And so ends the story. It's a sad ending. It's a sad finish to what could have been an excellent, promising career. A man who started out right, but he got off track, just like his father and his grandfather had done before him. In terms of application this morning, as we finish up, who's been a model or a mentor for you? Take a minute here and think about that. Who is somebody that I look up to or I've looked up to over a period of my life that's influenced me? Remember, leadership is influence. To the degree that you influence people, you are leading them by example. Who's been a model or a mentor for you? And conversely, who are you modeling for or mentoring today? Who's looking up to you? And if someone does look up to you, what do they see in you? What do they see in me? Then finally, will you finish strong? Or like Joash, will you stumble sometime before the finish? Robertson McQuilkin's words from his poem struck me years ago as true. "Few, they tell me, finish strong." It's a sad admission, isn't it? Not hard to get started. I mean, let's go. Let's get this thing on the road. Let's get moving. It's another matter to stay on track, isn't it? And finish strong. The Apostle John, in his letter to the churches in his day, makes a reference that is out of place to me. Every now and then you read a part of the scripture and it's curious. You say, why is this here? Why did they include this? Why did Jesus say that? I don't understand that. He writes his whole five-chapter letter, 1 John, and the theme is love. It's the love of God. He's all about love. He's the apostle of love, the apostle whom Jesus loved. He's the one that records Jesus' words, the new commandment, to love one another. And so he reiterates that repetitively in his letter to the churches, 1 John. But he finishes his letter, the fifth chapter, the final verse, with these words: "Dear children, keep yourself from idols." Keep yourself from idols. The greatest temptation of God's people has always been idolatry. Always, invariably. To worship and serve false gods, other gods, rather than the one true God. In the beginning, God created man in his own image. From the beginning, since the beginning, man has repetitively recreated God in his own image, to his liking and likeness. Idolatry. Boy, I think we see that clearly here in Chronicles, don't we? As we look at these profiles of the kings of Judah. Lord, I thank you for your word this morning, and we're challenged once again as we look at, boy, the life of Joash, certainly, but the influence of a mentor in his life, Jehoiada. He was a bright light in a dark era. And I'm struck by the reality that all of us have some degree of influence in others' lives. And my concern, Lord, is that we would lead others, not astray, never, but that we would lead others well towards you, to life, the kind of life that you would have us to live. May we, like that ancient priest, step up wherever needed, move out in your name, do what's right, do what's good, make a difference, and as a result, model to the next generation the virtues, the advantages of following God. May our example be clear. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you for spending time to listen to today's podcast, Design for Life. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, let me encourage you to donate to this ministry. You will find a donate tab at BethelGilead.org. Until then, go out and experience the design for life as God's ambassadors commissioned to a world in need of the gospel. God bless.